Welcome to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and advanced physics students from Roaring Fork Valley High Schools. The students spend a week working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the distinguished physicists who are here. I'm Patty Fox, and I'm hosting today's program, which was recorded during the teen summer program at the Aspen Center for Physics. With me today are Lily McCracken from Glenwood Springs High School and Freya Perrin from Aspen High School. They will be interviewing Samuel E. Gralla from the University of Arizona. Professor Gralla is a theorist working at the interface between physics and astronomy. He specializes in black holes and neutron stars whose extreme density makes gravity and electromagnetism behave in strange ways and produce unique emissions from radio to X-ray to gravitational waves, the newest field that everyone is excited about. He received his PhD from the University of Chicago in 2011 and did postdoctoral work at Maryland and Harvard before joining the University of Arizona in 2015. I will also add that he is the father of an adorable two-year-old, and if he can talk to that two-year-old, he can make us understand too. Can't you? So let's begin today with Lily.
Hi, I just wanted to ask you just a little bit to explain what you do at the University of Arizona, the classes you teach, and how you got into it.
Okay, well, first of all, thanks so much for having me on this program. It's a great pleasure. It's so great you do something like this. I'm happy to participate. So the teaching I do at the University of Arizona thus far has just been graduate level teaching. I've only been there 2 years. So I have taught my specialty, which is general relativity, Einstein's theory of gravity that we use to describe black holes and neutron stars that I work on. And I've also taught a classical mechanics course. So, you know, good old inclined planes and balls rolling down them and fancier ways to describe that. I've been figured out how to mathematically derive parallel parking, which was a little fun practical in quotes. And then, of course, I also do research as part of my job. How did I get into it? That's a sort of a much longer story, but, you know, I've sort of always been interested in physics. Well, not always, maybe going back to college when I really took physics and fell in love with it. And, you know, at each step of the long road to becoming a professor, I just stayed with it and it worked out for me, and I'm happy with that.
What parts of your research are you most excited about?
Ooh, what parts? Well, the most exciting thing for me is when I can make connections between different fields. So there's lots of good things to do in research. I'm not saying this is the only fun thing, but for me personally, you know, so for example, we've been working a lot on black holes that spin really fast. So a black hole is an astronomical object and it can spin like any other object, but there's an upper limit to how fast it can spin because its surface, roughly speaking, can't go faster than the speed of light. And so we realized over the last few years that in this regime where it starts going near the speed of light, it starts to behave like some condensed matter system, roughly, that we know about. And so those connections are fun.
So would you explain just exactly what a black hole is and how does it relate to a gravitational wave?
Great question. Yeah, so the basics. So a black hole is actually a really simple object, and you might think of it as abstruse and complex, but at a fundamental level, it's really the simplest thing in the universe, except for maybe a fundamental particle. Put straightforwardly, it's a region of space that nothing can escape from, not even light. And that's all you have to say to define a black hole, and believe it or not, these things exist. They form after stars collapse. There's a long story, but these things exist out there. And gravitational waves, well, gravitational waves are basically, so right now you can't see me because it's radio, but I'm shaking my fist, okay. And anytime matter moves around, the gravitational force that matter exerts kind of changes. And it doesn't change instantaneously, okay? It has to propagate out at the speed of light. And we call that a gravitational wave. Now, black holes are connected to gravitational waves because, well, when I shake my fist, I make gravitational waves, but I don't really make a lot of them. They're not very strong. To detect gravitational waves, you need something really dense shaking really hard. And that's where black holes come in. They're the densest things in the universe. And if two of them orbit each other, that's a pretty hard fist shake. And that makes the gravitational waves that were recently detected by this LIGO experiment.
So could you explain a bit more about the LIGO experiment and perhaps any role that you had in it?
Yeah, well, so first of all, I had no role in the LIGO experiment. I'm a theorist. I can't take any credit for their amazing work. I wasn't even born when LIGO was conceived. I mean, LIGO, really started in 72 with Ray Weiss at MIT, who just started thinking about interferometers. I guess I should explain what LIGO is first. This is going to be a long answer to your question because it's a long and fascinating story. Ray Weiss and others realized that you could measure very sensitive changes in distance. That's what a wave does. It washes over you, it kind of wiggles you. And you could measure these very sensitive changes in distances by bouncing lasers off mirrors and looking at the interference pattern when the two lasers combine. And that was the basic idea. And it took 40 years, 50 years, I guess, of continuous research and development to build, not one, but two, of these devices that bounce lasers off mirrors. There's one in Washington State, there's one in Livingston, Louisiana, and they're 4 kilometers long. So they bounce laser light out 4 kilometers and back, and they combine it with another beam. And they can use that to very sensitively measure the changes in the positions of the mirrors. There was 10, 20 years of internal research and development. The NSF picked it up and funded the whole thing through 20 years of ups and downs. They had the vision to keep it going, and they made this spectacular breakthrough about 1.5 years ago, finally detecting gravitational waves for the first time.
And what is the source of the gravitational waves that they detected that first time?
It was indeed two black holes orbiting around each other, like we just mentioned, yeah.
So what is the difference between a star like our sun exploding and something, another star, either becoming a neutron star or a black hole?
So it all depends on the mass of the star. It's clear you know a little bit about stellar evolution. That's great. So the sun is not quite massive enough to become a black hole. The way it works is the sun is kind of held up by the fusion going on in its core. Otherwise, it wants to collapse under gravity. But when the fuel for that fusion runs out, the star collapses. And then there's a whole host of interesting physics determining whether other forces can oppose that collapse. And it turns out for our sun, yeah, there are some other forces that can oppose that collapse. But for a star much more massive than the sun, there are no forces that can oppose the collapse. It will effectively collapse indefinitely and turn into a black hole. So it's all the mass of the star that matters.
So would you mind explaining the difference between a neutron star and a black hole and how different stars can evolve those two different ways?
Yeah. So, I mean, we haven't even introduced neutron stars on this program, so let me do that. Yeah, so a neutron star is a, you know, equally fascinating and amazing object. It's the mass of the sun, roughly, in the size of, well, it's bigger than Aspen. We always say Manhattan for the size of it, but it's this incredibly dense object. And it's basically made of pure neutrons. That's why it's called a neutron star. And so neutron stars form if the star is a little more massive than the sun, but not too massive, not more than, say, 2 or 3 times the mass of the sun. And in that case, what opposes the collapse, so the star collapses, but what opposes the collapse is something called the Pauli exclusion principle, which you may have heard of, which is basically the idea that two things can't be in the same place. So the neutrons have a Pauli exclusion principle, and the gravity crushes the star, so the neutrons are so close together that roughly the Pauli exclusion principle is preventing them from collapsing even further. And that stable state is a neutron star. Black hole is if it just keeps collapsing, and then it really turns into kind of pure gravity in this marvelous way that Einstein's theory describes.
So what will happen to our sun when it explodes? And do you think that it would destroy all life on Earth?
So I don't know too much about stellar structure. I focus on more exotic objects, but my understanding is that the sun would first become a red giant. So it would puff up and become very large, and that would engulf the Earth. And I don't actually know what would happen to the Earth. That's a practical question for people of, you know, a few billion years from now, I think. But I personally actually don't know the answer.
So part of your research revolves around studying what happens when black holes start spinning very rapidly and some of the phenomena that are associated with that. So could you explain what exactly you've found?
Yeah.
In research.
The most fun thing we found as a part of this was a new gravitational wave signal. So, well, we didn't discover it, a new signature. So if you go to like YouTube or the LIGO website, LIGO is the experiment that detected gravitational waves, you can actually hear a recording of the signal. So, you know, it's a gravitational wave, it's not sound. But like any wave, it has a frequency and an amplitude, and you can convert it into a sound wave. And so they did this, and you can listen to what the waves sound like that LIGO actually detected. And they're kind of like this. They go, yip. It's like a little chirp. And actually, we use that term. We call that the chirp. It has, you know, the frequency goes up, the amplitude goes up, and then it cuts off quickly. And that's the signature of a normal black hole. One of the things we found when we started unlocking this regime of rapid spin is that if you had a rapidly spinning black hole, really rapidly spinning, close to the speed of light, it doesn't sound like a chirp anymore. Instead of nyip, it sounds like kind of sits on a note and it falls off. And it's a little hard to explain why this happens, but I can try. Roughly, because the black hole is rapidly spinning, the other black hole can get really close before they collide. I can't really explain that, but that's a fact. And if they can get really close, they basically just co-rotate. They're like one object spinning around together. And then you just have one frequency in your gravitational waves. You hear one note at the end. So we discovered that, you know, this chirp, which is the calling card of the black hole merger that everyone has been talking about for decades, really, there's one case where they don't chirp. So we're hoping the next thing LIGO sees is, a song, not a chirp.
So how many black holes do you think there are in our universe? And how do the gravitational waves from each of them interfere?
So gravitational waves don't interfere too much. They kind of pass right by each other. That's related to the fact that they're so hard to generate in the first place. They're just very weakly interacting. To even make some, you need a really big, fast thing like a black hole. LIGO saw gravitational waves from a single system. There was a merging, well, three now, but they're just one event. Black holes merge. There's a burst of radiation, and LIGO observed that. They also look for so-called stochastic backgrounds, which would be from all the black holes in the universe that found themselves in binaries going around each other, just the sum of all those signals. And they haven't found that yet, but that would be sort of like what you're asking about. Now, for the next mission called LISA, which will go into space in 2 decades, but it's funded, it will go, then they actually will, they view that as a source of noise. They'll be so annoyed at all the gravitational waves from all the actually white dwarf binaries, another kind of a star, that they want to somehow take that out. Now, you also asked how many black holes there are. That's another question I'm not really prepared to answer. I'm just going to have to punt on that one. I don't know the numbers, but many, 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 many black holes in the universe.
So most of your work is theoretical, obviously, but do you think that any of those theoretical findings will be put to the test now that we have the LISA experiment going into effect, as well as the Event Horizon Telescope?
I certainly hope to, you know, it'd be nice if LISA observed some of the signals we predicted. Yeah, I view my work, I'm not so much testing gravity, I'm using gravity to learn about potential signatures like this song rather than chirp that would then teach us astrophysics. So I'm certainly hoping for that. You mentioned the Event Horizon Telescope. So that's a really exciting experiment that's happening now. It's a worldwide network of radio dishes or millimeter wave dishes that is trying to actually take a picture of a black hole. So there's a supermassive black hole, meaning it has millions, a mass of about a million suns in the center of our galaxy. And this Event Horizon Telescope is trying to take a picture of that for the first time, really resolve the size of the black hole, not just see it as a point. And yeah, we're making a prediction for that too. It's not out yet, but it turns out if the black hole in the center of our galaxy were rapidly spinning, really rapidly spinning, the picture you take would look very different than if it weren't. So maybe they'll see that.
So where and when do you conduct your research, and are your students at all involved in it?
The great thing about being a theorist, theoretical physicist in particular, is you can conduct your research anywhere you want, anytime you want. So I basically need, you know, a pen and paper or a laptop running a computer program called Mathematica, or maybe I need to talk to some collaborators as well, which can also be done over Skype. So of course I do most of my work, you know, at work in Arizona, but you can work here in Aspen, and you can work at night when you just got the kid to bed and, you know, have an hour and so forth. So I have one student now, and he's working on more of a fundamental physics question, but he's certainly involved in my research. He's working on a instability of rapidly rotating black holes that was recently discovered. So when we think of an instability, it's a little bit like if you tried to balance a pencil on its tip. If you balanced it exactly, it would just stand on its point forever. But of course, it's going to fall over. You know, if the wind blows a tiny bit, it's going to fall over. That's an example of an instability. When the black hole is rotating at exactly the maximum allowed, so its event horizon, the edge of the black hole, is going at the speed of light, it's unstable, like a pencil being balanced on its tip. And now you want to ask what happens. So for the pencil, we know what happens. It falls over, it hits the table, right? But that's a big change in the system, so that's interesting. What happens to this instability for the black hole? We don't really know. We're trying to ask that question, and that involves solving a lot of complicated mathematical equations.
So are all black holes unstable, or are they not?
No, this only happens when the black hole is rotating at exactly the speed of light. So the black holes in our universe are perfectly stable, and that's good, because if we wouldn't see them, if they were unstable, they would have turned into something else, like the pencil falling over and hitting the table.
Since the speed of light is the universal speed limit, how could the event horizon travel at the speed of light?
Well, it can go arbitrarily close. And so we approximate arbitrarily close as exactly at the speed of light when we solve the equations.
Do you think that there is a point when the black hole at the center of our galaxy could become unstable?
Maybe, if we're lucky. I mean, there's no reason to expect that a random black hole like the one in our random galaxy in the random corner of the universe would be spinning this fast, right? You need a mechanism to make it spin that fast. And there are some. Many black holes in the universe are surrounded by a disk of matter, which we call an accretion disk. Accretion means adding matter to the black hole. The matter's falling in. And as it falls in, the disk is rotating. It's kind of like water in your bathtub when it drains. It ends up rotating a little bit as it drains. Similarly, the matter ends up, the disk is rotating, and so the matter carries angular momentum into the black hole, carries its rotation into the black hole, makes the black hole rotate faster. So that mechanism could make black holes rotate arbitrarily fast and reach this unstable point. Whether the black hole in our universe is rotating that fast, I'd guess not, but maybe we'll be lucky for me, and, you know, my research will then have an impact on that black hole.
So I believe you also researched the magnetic flux around black holes. Is there a relationship between gravity and the magnetic field, or is it a result of the black hole spinning?
So black holes have a property that was called a black hole has no hair. It's a very funny name. I don't know where these names exactly came from. But an example of hair is a magnetic field. So black hole actually can't have its own magnetic field. There are magnetic fields near black holes, but they come from this accretion disk I was talking about. If the disk is magnetized, and almost everything in the universe seems to be magnetized at some level, then there'll be magnetic fields around the black hole. So that's really the source of the magnetic field there. But it interacts with the black hole in very interesting ways. And for example, probably helps give rise to this phenomenon of relativistic jets. You should Google these pictures, Google quasar, Q-U-A-S-A-R, and you'll see these amazing pictures of, you know, there's a tiny galaxy, a speck in the middle of the picture, and a huge jet of particles flying out of the galaxy. And it's like a pencil in a straight line for, you know, 1,000 times the size of the galaxy. And we think the magnetic field has an important role to play in that, launching that jet.
So some of your research involves plasma and black holes. Will you explain the connection between those?
Yeah, that's a perfect segue. So this process I was talking about, whereby this jet is produced, depends crucially on magnetic fields, as I just mentioned, and on plasma. And the reason is basically because you need to find enough energy to power this jet. It's very hard to understand where all that energy comes from, because it originates right in the center of the galaxy. And our best guess is it comes from the black hole in the center of the galaxy. But how do you get energy out of a black hole if a black hole is something nothing can come out of? To make these giant relativistic jets I was telling you about, it turns out you need three ingredients. You need a rotating black hole, you need magnetic fields, and you need plasma. And to understand why that's the case, we can think of an analogy. It's very similar to something called a Faraday wheel, which was the first electrical generator discovered by Michael Faraday. Faraday wheel has these three ingredients. It has a rotating conducting disk instead of a black hole, but it has that rotating disk. It has a magnetic field threading the disk, and it has wires that connects this to a circuit. And the plasma is the analog of the wires. Plasma is free electrons and protons or positrons and lets there be electricity that's conducted much like the wires. So the Faraday wheel is an electrical generator that can power a light bulb by the rotating disk in the magnetic field via the wires. And these relativistic jets, we think, are the analog. They're powered by the rotating black hole in the magnetic field via the plasma. So that's in part why I work on plasma as well.
So does the black hole at the center of our own galaxy have these plasma jets?
Probably not, but it's not totally clear. We think no, but we're learning more and more about that observationally. There is a nearby black hole in the center of the galaxy, M87, which has a beautiful jet. It was discovered like almost 100 years ago in the optical. The person doing it wrote that there was a curious straight ray or something. And more now we're resolving the system. And the Event Horizon Telescope, which you mentioned earlier, is also going to look right at that jet at the base. And we hope we'll learn much more about this process of launching the jet.
So what determines if a black hole does have plasma?
It's a combination of the rotation rate of the black hole, the strength of the and the strength of the magnetic field around it due to the accretion disk. The exact details aren't that well understood, but basically what happens is if the black hole is rotating fast enough, it can kind of spontaneously create the plasma by an instability, which we were discussing before, which is basically if you drop in a single charged particle near this rotating black hole, the electric fields that are caused by the rotation will accelerate that charged particle to really high energies. And then a bunch of interesting quantum electrodynamical processes take over that actually start creating electrons and positrons from the vacuum. And that process is understood, but we don't know exactly when it turns on and when it doesn't. And we think it's related to the question you asked a minute ago, which is which black holes have jets and which don't, because you need the plasma to make the jet.
Is it possible for other stars or white dwarfs to have plasma?
Well, they definitely have jets. They're certainly good old-fashioned stars with jets. Jets are a pretty ubiquitous phenomenon, though they're not as spectacular as these ones that come from supermassive black holes. Neutron stars can have jets, and those are powered by plasma. Now, plasma is ubiquitous in the universe. I should be careful. Plasma is basically everywhere. So you may have learned there are three states of matter or something. I don't know if they left off plasma. That's the fourth, and that's the most common in the universe. So plasma is everywhere. The particular regime of plasma physics I'm talking about, where you generate it by this instability and it has to do with rotation and so forth, that's basically confined to neutron stars and black holes because they're dense enough and rotating fast enough to trigger this instability.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Gralla, for a really interesting interview in which I at least learned a great deal of astronomy. I really never had a definition of plasma. That alone, I'm grateful for. Thank you. And thank you to Lily McCracken and Freya Perrin for interviewing and having such really great questions for Professor Gralla. And if you Google Sam, G-R-A-L-L-A, you'll also find a link to a public lecture he gave recently, Rethinking Reality, which I have to say I haven't watched yet, but I'm going to watch it because it's something that we're all questioning. What is reality? Tune in to Radio Physics on the fourth Tuesday of every month at 4:30 for more information about the Gopher program and events at the center. Please visit the Aspen Center for Physics website at aspenphys.org.